All right, Luke chapter 12. We're kind of halfway through Timothy, and I figured that's probably a good place, good enough place to stop for a while. And so let's read from Luke chapter 12, from verse 13 through to verse 21. You see that it's a parable. It's a parable, and it's a parable of the rich fool. Someone in the crowd said to him, "Teacher, tell my brother to divide the inheritance with me." Clearly, Jesus is talking to a big group of people. And if you read the early part of chapter 12, you'll see that Jesus has been talking about some pretty heavy stuff. And he has obviously somebody who wasn't concentrating. And how do you know he wasn't concentrating? Because he comes off on this tangent. Suddenly a thought flashes in his mind. Without mind being mindful of what Jesus has been talking about, he says, "Teacher, tell my brother to divide his inheritance with me." He wasn't listening, but he's got a question. Jesus replied, "Man, who appointed me a judge or an arbiter between you?" Then he said to them, "Watch out, be on your guard against all kinds of greed. Life does not consist in an abundance of possessions." So his response is initially to the man. He's responding to him. And he says, "Who appointed me a judge?" And then he lifts his eyes and he speaks to the crowd, and he says, "Watch out, be on your guard against all kinds of greed." And then he tells him this parable. "The ground of a certain rich man yielded an abundant harvest. He thought to himself, 'What shall I do? I have no place to store my crops.' Then he said, 'This is what I'll do.'" This is the man with this abundant harvest, says, "This is what I'll do. I will tear down my barns, build bigger ones, and there I will store my surplus grain. And I'll say to myself," now he's talking to himself, this rich man, "I'll say to myself, 'You have plenty of grain laid up for many years. Take life easy. Eat, drink, and be merry.' But God said to him, 'You fool, this very night your life will be demanded from you. Then who will get what you have prepared for yourself? This is how it will be with those who store up things for themselves but are not rich towards God." I know that I've got a sermon on here somewhere. Come on, where is it? I told you, you're not praying for me like I asked you to pray the other day. It's got to be, oh, there it is. Okay, yes, all right. We can all relax, all breathe a sigh of relief. We live in a society that applauds ambition, and we live in a society that applauds those who put away for the future, but those kind of things that we applaud raise some pretty practical questions, like when does ambition become greed? And when does prudence regarding retirement become selfishness? You know, maybe you never thought about that, but I think it's something that is important to look at. And a third question which kind of arises from that is this one: what is the balance between greed and ambition, between prudence and storing up for our future? We have a series of parables which are found in Luke's Gospel, between Luke chapter 9, verse 51, where we read that Jesus set his face towards Jerusalem. And then he goes down to Jerusalem, and the section closes in Luke chapter 19, verse 27, where we see that Jesus arrives in Jerusalem. So you've got him leaving Galilee for Jerusalem, you've got him arriving in Jerusalem, and during that period, he tells a bunch of parables. And these parables have become known as travel stories. And because they kind of told from leaving to arriving, people have called these stories travel stories and have seen them as symbolic of our lives between Sundays, of the way we live our lives after we leave church on Sunday until we get back to church, the Monday to Saturday life. These parables are geared for that time between Sundays. They tell us how to live between Sundays. And our parable is an example of one of those practical parables that tell us how to live between Sundays. And it may even help us answer that question, what is the balance between greed and ambition? What is the balance between astute retirement planning and selfishness? Now, that's the big context. The immediate context is also important, and we've already seen something of the immediate context. We have these introductory verses where, as we see, someone in the crowd said, "Teacher, tell my brother to divide the inheritance with me." Now, that is obviously a legal question. And the legal provisions for inheritance fell under Torah. The first five books of the Bible, Genesis, Exodus, Leviticus, Numbers, Deuteronomy, collectively that is called the Torah. And that's where the legal issues are dealt with. And if a Jew had a legal problem like this inheritance thing, he went to an expert in Torah. And the rabbis were the expert in Torah. Jesus was regarded as a rabbi, and so he goes to Jesus for the answer to his problem. What does Torah say about inheritance? And so we read Torah, and we read this in Deuteronomy. We read that the father must acknowledge the inheritance rights of the real firstborn by giving him a double share of the inheritance. For various reasons, the firstborn got a double portion of his father's estate. Now, clearly, there had been a death in the family, and the one son had not been willing to meet his obligations as far as inheritance was concerned regarding the other son. And that other son feels aggrieved by it. And so he goes to Rabbi Jesus, and he asks him to arbitrate. And when we read it, at first glance, it would appear reasonable. It would seem that the son just wanted justice. That's all. I want justice, Jesus. But Jesus is able to see the hearts of people, and he sees something a little bit differently. And so he says, then Jesus said to them, "Watch out, be on your guard against all kinds of greed." So justice seemed to be what he wanted, and there's nothing wrong with that, of course, it's good. But Jesus sees something else. He sees the real issue here as being greed. What is greed? It's the desire to have more than one's due without reference to what you really need, and certainly without reference to the needs of others. That's what greed is. Wanting more than is your due without reference to what you actually need, and without reference to the needs of others. And so here is Jesus' warning. He says, life does not consist in an abundance of possessions. In other words, life isn't simply about having stuff and getting more stuff. Watch out, says Jesus, be on your guard against wanting more than is your due. You see, it's true. Life is not defined by what we have. We, as individuals, are not defined by what we have. It is not true that the one who dies with the most toys wins. It's not true. It's not true. And so from the introductory verses, we know what Jesus is addressing through this parable. He's saying, be on your guard against all kinds of greed. Be on your guard against wanting more than your due. Why? Because life does not consist in an abundance of possessions. Now, that's quite a sensitive issue. When this guy comes, presumably or purportedly, with a problem of justice, and yet Jesus needs to address a sensitive issue like the man's greedy. How do you do that without closing down the conversation? You see, it is so easy to become judgmental in a situation. And as we all know, because we are people, we are so easily offended when people kind of, we think, misjudge our motives and we're not willing to give them really due consideration. We get easily offended. So how do we do it? Well, how did Jesus do it? He told a story. He told a parable. A story that deals with a common everyday issue, but if we engage with the story, or let me put that the other way around, if we allow the story to engage us, suddenly we find that Jesus has put his finger on a raw spot. Of course, it doesn't always work like that. Approaching something indirectly doesn't always work. It's a risk we've got to take. Maybe the person's not going to be willing to engage, but Jesus was willing to take the chance. He tells a story. Now let me throw some stuff out there just to make it more interesting. If we talk for a moment about a narrative reading of the Bible. All stories, all narratives have a plot. And all plots have at least three elements. They have the element where a tension is built up in the story. Then they have a resolution to that tension. And then there is a result. Now, you read your novels and you'll see that there's going to be a tension build up and then there's going to be some kind of resolution. Maybe there'll be another tension build up with another resolution. It doesn't have to flow kind of in a linear fashion, but those are the three elements you'll find in any story, in any narrative, and you'll find it in the narrative portions of the Bible. Those three elements will in some way be there. Now, let's take that and apply it to Jesus' story. Let's look for those three elements. Let's look for the tension that is built up. The ground of a certain rich man produced a good crop. And so he thought to himself, what shall I do with it? Where shall I place my crops? Now that's a good tension. I mean, who doesn't want that tension if you've got your own business? But it is a tension, an excellent harvest. That brought the tension of, what shall I do with this? Where shall I store it? Next we see a resolution. Then he said, this is what I will do. I will tear down my barns, build bigger and bigger ones, and there I will store all my grain and my goods. It's a resolution to the tension introduced by an abundance of crops. I'm going to build bigger barns. And this brings about the result that the farmer had hoped for. And I'll say to myself, you have plenty of good things laid up for many years. Take life easy, eat, drink, and be merry. That's the problem. This man didn't take God into account. But God said, you fool, this very night your life will be demanded from you. Then who will get what you have prepared for yourself? And so we ask ourselves, well, what is going on here? Surely the farmer wasn't doing anything wrong. Surely he wasn't a fool to look to secure his future. I mean, isn't there a parable somewhere else where the servant is commended for taking what Jesus gives him, investing it, and getting a good return on it? What's going on here? Before we answer that question, and in order to help us answer that question, let me introduce another pointer in a narrative reading of the Bible. Read the story carefully. You can't just skim through. You see, if you read a story, and particularly a biblical story, you've got to read it from the point of view that the author wrote it like he did because he wanted to say that and not something different. And we believe that Jesus told the story like that and not in a different way. We need to read the story carefully. Let's read the story carefully. The ground of a certain man, rich man, yielded an abundant harvest. Now answer the question, what was the source of the farmer's abundance? We are told, the ground. Jesus could have said, a certain man worked the ground diligently and obtained an abundant harvest. Can you see how wording it that way would have put a different point, would have painted a different picture? The way Jesus told the story, he wanted to show us that the ground was responsible. Jesus is making sure we understand that the farmer had been blessed with fertile soil. If Jesus had said it, emphasizing the man's hard work, it would have painted a different story. That the man's diligence and hard work was rewarded by abundance. Now, diligence and hard work are crucial. But that isn't the point of this story. In this story, Jesus wants to make the point the abundance was because of the ground. And here we have the farmer's first mistake. He did not recognize that it was the ground. In other words, he did not recognize that it was the blessing of God. He did not recognize that God was responsible for his abundance. It wasn't his hard work or diligence or anything like that. It was God who was responsible for the abundance which brought about the tension. No worries. The farmer has a resolution. This is what I'll do. I will tear down my barns and build bigger ones, and there I will store my surplus grain, and I'll say to myself. That's a tricky question. I don't know whether you'll get this one. What is the dominant pronoun there? Second mistake. He focused on himself to the exclusion of anyone else and to the exclusion of God. He left God out of the picture. The plot of the story produced a tension, an abundant harvest. The farmer found a resolution, more and bigger barns. This led for the hoped-for result. The farmer hoped that it would mean that you, the farmer still talking himself, have plenty of grain laid up for many years. Take life easy. Drink and be merry. It was all about him, about what he could do for himself. Question, what is wrong with planning for the future? Is it wrong to plan for a good retirement? Of course not. Why then is this the farmer's third mistake? The clue to his third mistake is found in verse 16, the ground of a certain rich man. Remember what greed is? Greed is the desire to have more than one's due. Greed is the desire to get one's hands on whatever one can without reference to what I actually need and without reference to the needs of others. Remember Jesus' warning? Life does not consist in an abundance of possessions, verse 15. Life isn't about having lots of things, desiring lots of things. Can you see the father's third mistake? The farmer's third mistake? Greed. Selfishness. Not being willing to share. He is already rich. And of course, rich is a relative concept. When I was away, Nigel spoke about how we are all rich. Of course, there's always going to be need. We cannot single-handedly meet every need. But we will be held accountable for needs we could have met. But greed kept us from meeting those needs. We will be held accountable for needs which we could have met. But our greed kept us from meeting those needs. Which brings us to the farmer's fourth and final mistake. Remember that pronoun that was so dominant in verse 18 and 19, I and my? That is the language of control. I am the master of my destiny. I am the captain of my own ship. We like to be in control. I know I do. And I'm totally comfortable with people who are proactive so that they plan. I really am. But I think there needs to be some humility. And I think that our text makes that plain. Our farmer wanted to be in control of his future so that his future included having more and more and more. I can control my future, or so he thought. But God said to him, you fool. This very night, your life will be demanded from you. Big reality check. There are things in our lives over which we have control. There are things in our lives over which we should exercise control. But I want us to all understand this. At best, we can fine-tune certain aspects of our lives because the big things are outside of our control. Who of you, tell me, chose your parents? And that's quite a big thing in your life, I think. Who chose your race? Who chose the culture into which you were going to be born? Who chose your that these are the life chances that I want? Who chose your health? Did Caesar choose to have a tumor? Of course he didn't. Who chose your body shape? I would have chosen a different body shape, I want to tell you. Who chose your ball skills? Well, I didn't choose mine because I've got zip ball skills. Okay? None of us chose these things. We have no choice in those big things. And yet, who of us choose to work hard to maximize our potential? Who of us choose hard to hone our ball skills? I gave that one up long ago. Who of us choose to exercise and eat well to maintain some kind of body shape? Who of us choose to grab the opportunities that are presented to us? Who of us choose not to let adversity set us back? It is true, most things, the important things, are chosen for us, but yet there are some things we can choose and must choose. But let's understand that at best we are fine-tuning, making the most of our situation because the big decisions have already been made for us. And we fine-tune by making wise, God-honoring choices in the context of the big decisions that have already been made for us, in the context of what we have been given. We fine-tune by doing what we can with what we have been given. And so we do it with humility, because we know that the big things are outside our control. And this is graphically seen in our story. After controlling everything, or so he thought, he died. No control over the big things. And we need to let our attitude in life be moderated by what James tells us. Now listen, you who say, today or tomorrow we will go to this or that city, spend a year there, carry on business, and make money. Why? You do not even know what will happen tomorrow. What is your life? You're a mist that appears for a little while and then vanishes. Instead, you ought to say, if it is the Lord's will, we will live and do this or that. You see, our planning, our trying to exercise some sort of control, needs to show a little humility. A rich man, an abundant crop, nothing wrong with that. A rich man using his wealth to generate more, nothing wrong with that. A rich man doing his best to exercise some measure of control over his future security, nothing wrong with that. So where's the problem? Why does Jesus call him fool? Because he did it with a disregard for others and their needs around him. He did it without regard for God's view on these things. He did it thinking that he was in control, not accountable to anyone. But in the final analysis, he had very little control over the big things, and neither do we. God said to him, you fool, this very night your life will be demanded from you. Who then will get what you have prepared for yourself? And so Jesus gives us a warning. This then is how it will be for those who store up things for themselves, but are not rich towards God. And there we are shown how to make sure that we don't cross the line from financial astuteness to greed. See, this isn't a criticism of wealth. Neither is it saying, watch out, God's going to get you. I'm not saying that. We're going to die anyway. Let's get used to that idea. Somebody said to me the other day, hey, life is terminal. That's true. Life is terminal. We're all going to die. This is a warning against greed, against wanting more without reference to what we actually need, without reference to the needs of others. It's a warning for those of us who define ourselves by our possessions. It's a warning against us. And I want to say that greed is a temptation we will all face. It's like greed is a virus in our systems. And when our devotional life is good, when we are walking close to God, when we've got no obedience issue with God, where we're fighting Him on something, well, our immune system can deal with the greed virus. Sadly, our immune systems can become compromised. We become discontent. We want more. We ignore the needs of others. We start building bigger barns, and it's insidious. And it's easy to hide behind the guise of, oh God, you are so good. I want to enjoy the abundance of your gifts. Oh Lord, don't you say in your word, every good and perfect gift comes from you. Don't we enjoy the applause of society that we astute business people or whatever? And then this parable. Simple story. Easy for us to dismiss. Easy to say, well, I'm not a farmer. We don't build barns. But then the parable starts to niggle. And we wish we hadn't heard it. Because then we've got to start working really hard to avoid examining our motives. Or we can choose to get honest with ourselves as we say, Lord, hear my finances. You look at them. Allow Him to search it. Allow Him to deal with our motives. Deal with the greed, if there is any. And embrace the antidote. Become rich towards God. It's the only way to ultimately enjoy peace with God and in our relationship with others. Let's spend a few moments just thinking about some of this stuff, shall we?